Five, four, three, two, one, fire!
You are listening to StMichaelsPod.com. We have taken over control of your iPod or other MP3 listening device. Resistance is futile at this point. God's message will not self-destruct, whether you choose to accept his mission or not. At this time, we recommend that you relax, let go, and let God.
Hello and welcome back to StMichaelsPod.com. This is Mike Barone, your normal host for the podcast, and I wanted to introduce you today to a very wonderful friend of mine, Mr. Thomas Serafin, who is the president of the International Center for Holy Relics. Tom has a wonderful collection of holy relics, and he travels around the country and gives presentations on the different saints and their relics. We've had him out to St. Francis de Sales in Newark, Ohio. He was very wonderful, did some excellent presentations for the parish, the whole parish, and did some extensive work with us for the Dead Theologian Society as well. So sit back and listen to Mr. Tom Serafin as he explains a little bit more about relics.
Hello and welcome. My name is Tom Serafin. I am the president of the International Center for Holy Relics, which can be found on the web at www.ichrusa.com. Today I will discuss the veneration of relics. There are only a few points of faith that can be traced back to the earliest ages of Christianity, and one of them is the veneration of relics. It's not really easy to determine the period at which the practice of venerating small fragments of bone and cloth first became common. We can only say that it was widespread early in the 4th century, and that dated inscriptions upon blocks of stone, which are probably altar slabs like we have today in a common altar, give us evidence which is quite conclusive. One of them was found in northern Africa and now preserved in the Christian Museum of the Louvre, and it bears a list of relics probably once cemented into the sepulchre cavity excavated in its surface. By the end of the 4th century, the Roman calendar was almost complete. Not long after that, the various calendars were combined to compile martyrologies. This is a list of names and brief details of a certain number of martyrs belonging to different local churches whose anniversaries occurred on the same day. Standing out among these is that of St. Jerome, which is at the basis of all of those which followed and were diffused into the Roman liturgy and used in the divine office as well as in private readings. Comparing the Philo calendar, St. Jerome's martyrology, and the calendars of the Roman Church of the 11th century, we see that the first records list only the martyrs of Rome, indicating the place where the anniversary was celebrated, and this is true generally also of St. Jerome's martyrology. Documentation on a devotion to martyrs in Rome, as it appears in Roman calendars from the late Middle Ages to the 13th century, continues to testify that in Rome only authentic Roman feasts were admitted, and that normally every church celebrated the feasts of its own martyrs. In the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries, the celebration of the anniversaries at the tombs of the martyrs was diffused, and the faithful had to organize vigils. This was a growing custom, which at times was even authorized. It was used to listen to the hagiographic readings relative to the martyr and his or her martyrdom. And these celebrations, the invocation of the martyrs, spreads throughout the churches. St. Ambrose asked his people to address their prayers to the saints that they may intercede for the forgiveness of sins. The great St. Augustine reveals to us that although the invocation of the martyrs was considered a fact in the Christian communities in the 4th century, the liturgical expression of devotion to them was still very discreet. Very early on, the memory of the martyrs became part of the great Eucharistic prayer in the Roman liturgy, and the Roman canon bears witness to this tradition. The bond between the blood of the martyrs and the Eucharist is seen also from the traditions regarding the altar, which, from the early times, was to contain the relics of martyrs carried in solemn procession for the consecration and dedication of a new church. However, the custom later became hidden, with the use of portable altars and altar stones to be inserted into altars, and was extended also to relics of other saints, considered martyrs in spirit, although they did not have, as with St. Martin, the occasion of martyrdom. The veneration of relics associated with saints and martyrs has been practiced as far back as the 2nd century and may even be older. Luckily for us, some early examples of relic worship have been recorded. In a letter written about 156 AD, the Christians of Smyrna described the martyrdom of Bishop Polycarp, who had been burned to death shortly before. From this it appears that the Christians, in quotations, took up the bones, which were more valuable than refined gold, and laid them in a suitable place where, Lord willing, we may gather together in gladness and celebrate the anniversary of his martyrdom. During the most violent of all persecutions, that of Diocletian, in the years 303 to 311, relics of the martyrs were eagerly collected by their followers. After the death of St. Vincent, the onlookers dipped their clothes in his blood. And when 7 brothers were martyred in Samososa in 308, a number of noble ladies bribed the guards to let them wash the bodies with sponges and collect drops of blood. Christianity has thus long involved venerating bodily relics of saints and martyrs. The word relic in Latin means I leave or abandon. In the church, it generally means a part, sometimes of considerable size, of the remains of a martyr or saint. With the approval of the ecclesiastical authority, the relic can be the object of public and solemn veneration. The term relic includes the bodies of the departed saints, fragments of their bodies, articles and portions of articles which they have used, such as clothes, vestments, rosaries, and the like. The Church also venerates relics of Christ and His Blessed Mother, such as the holy nails, the lance, spear, fragments of the true cross, the girdle and the veil of the Blessed Virgin Mary. The devotion to relics is solemnly approved by the Council of the Trent and rests on 2 great principles of Catholic belief. The veneration of relics. Now, for the exposition and veneration of relics, they must be closed in reliquaries or sealed cases. This cited in Canon 1287, paragraph 1. A relic of the true cross, because of the respect owed to our Lord Jesus Christ, may not be placed in a reliquary together with other relics of saints, but must be kept apart. Canon 1288, paragraph 2. Relics of the cross and passion must be kept separate from other relics and given a special place of honor. When relics are exposed, at least 2 lights must be burning. Reliquaries should therefore be covered with small cloths when standing on the altar, and the ordinary candles are not lit. No relics may be placed upon the top of the tabernacle or in front of it. They may not be exposed on the same altar when the Blessed Sacrament is exposed, nor venerated during exposition. Relics of the Blessed may not be carried in procession or exposed, except in a place where, by permission of the Holy See, Mass and Office in their honor may be celebrated, Canon 1287, paragraph 3. In 1215, Canon 62 of the Fourth Lateran Council, inserted in the Corpus Juris, forbids relics to be sold or to be exposed outside of their cases or shrines, and prohibited the public veneration of new relics till their authenticity had been approved by the Pope. For the authentication of relics, the document that accompanies a relic is oftentimes referred to as the authentic. On the document, there is a variety of useful and necessary information. The document is a public acclamation as to the authenticity of the relic itself, of which a high-ranking ecclesiastic has signed his name. Typed or handwritten in the blank areas are the name and the abbreviation of the cause of the sainthood and the individual station in religious life, as well as any distinction or honor that the church might have placed on them posthumously. There is also a description of the relic itself and a description of the locket or reliquary that it is placed in. On the bottom of the authentic is the date of issuance, the seal of office, the registrar's number, and the signature of the authenticator. The purpose of the document is to declare the relic or relics authenticity, thereby allowing it to be publicly venerated. Underneath the back cover of the locket, on the back side of it, there is a seal of red wax. The relic is secured in place in the locket, or teka, by the threads that cross over it. The threads are inserted through the walls of the locket on opposing sides, and it is sealed shut with wax seal bearing the insignia of the issuing religious authority and their order's initials. This seal and its locking procedure, which are the threads and the wax seal, should never be broken or cut. It protects the integrity and validity of the authentication. On the head of the document is the name of the ecclesiastic or the office of the papal master of ceremonies who has authenticated the relic as genuine. This could be the postulator general of a religious order whose coat of arms appear on it, or the vicar general. Next, we'll describe the body of copy that is usually written in Latin or Italian, and I'll do a brief translation. To all and any persons who will read this document, we, the postulators in the cause of, that saint's name, canonization of, that saint's name, guarantee and testify that from the authentic relics which are preserved, we have extracted a particle from the body, which would be ex ossibus, of the same, and have placed it in a round case covered with crystal, bound by red colored thread and sealed with the seal of our office. Below it is the date in Rome, the signature, and the seal. In the process of trying to identify the specific relic that you have accompanied by the document, you will find that the explanation will be in Latin. I have compiled a glossary to provide you with the definitions of the most commonly used words and abbreviation. Being that I am not an expert in Latin, I have provided a PDF copy of all the descriptions and words that you can download from the website and print that and keep it with you. I'll give you just a few brief ones. Of course, in the case of hair, it's ex capillis, which is the hair. Ex carne is from the flesh. Ex domo is from the house. Ex indumentis is from the clothing. Ex ossibus from the bones. Precordius is from the stomach or from the intestines. The initials now that follow that name to which the relic belongs are also gives you an idea of the relic itself, being that there are initials at the name. For instance, AP is apostle, C is confessor, D is doctor of the church, E is bishop, EV evangelist, and so on. That's continued on the list. The next important step is to clarify the classification of the relic itself. There are three classes of relics: first class, second class, and third class. First class relic are the bodies of the saintly persons or any of their intricate parts, such as limbs and flesh, bones, ashes, and hair. Second class are objects that have come into physical contact with the living saints and are thereby sanctified. For instance, the instruments wherewith the martyr had been tortured, the chains by which he was bound, the clothes they wore, a hairbrush, a breviary, and so forth. Third class relics are bits of cloth touched to an actual first or second class relic. Now here is a common error. The cloth would have to be touched to the physical second or first class relic, meaning an exposed bone, for instance, in first class. Touching a piece of cloth to the outside of a reliquary or to a saint's tomb is simply a nice piece of memorabilia. In conclusion, I'd like to say that to the believer, the remains of the saints bring to pass a greater mystery. Through them, the unseen world has come closer. Their bodies, which were taken over and sanctified by the Holy Spirit to an incredible degree, have been venerated by the faithful who themselves seek such a transformation and hold that by the day's devotion, they and the relic have brought paradise nearer. The relics are not seen principally as wonder-working talismans, but first of all as evidence of an unseen world, of the saints in heaven, of the community of Christian people, past, present, and future, of what the historic creed calls the communion of saints. In a skeptical age, wonder-working relics inevitably have difficulty in proving their credentials. When you choose a saint or hero, you say quite as much about yourself as about the object of veneration. As the centuries passed, not all, but certainly many of the needs served by the saints and their relics, both psychological and physical, vary widely. If you wish to venerate a relic, you must first of all reject the evidence of your senses and reverse your normal perception of reality. Here, for one thing, is a piece of a former human being, now quite evidently lifeless, inanimate, and dead. Yet you are required to believe that this object not only represents eternal life, but also in some mysterious fashion can grant it. As we have seen, men and women have in the past managed to accept this bizarre attitude to human remains, and in many parts of the world still do. In studying the lives of the saints who have gone before us, all will find the stories exciting and extraordinary, because they bring to mind common and ordinary circumstances that we face daily. And they should warm our hearts and encourage us to face similarities. The readings of the lives of the saints will refresh us in memory what we know, because we easily forget what is good and need to have it to hold told to us again and again. And even though we hold it in our memory, we need to be reminded to quicken our will and our desire. Quoting Pope John Paul II, the saints have always been a source of origin of renewal in the most difficult times in church history. And who can forget St. Dominic's dying words of his brother? "Do not weep, for I shall be more useful to you after my death, and I shall help you then more effectively than during my life." So fix your eyes on the saints, our brothers and sisters who were as weak as we are, born into sin as you were, full of passion and temptations and evil inclinations as all of us. It is for this reason that the Mother Church puts before us the examples of the saints and celebrates their feast. For this end, it is a great help to read much and hear read the lives of the saints and consider their excellent heroic virtues. It being the intention of the Holy Mother Church and proposing to us their heroic deeds, to invite us at least to get out of our spiritual sloth. And there is another advantage in such study. It confounds and humbles us to consider this purity of life of these saints and how we fall so short of their examples. Remember, though, it is not the place nor the time that makes a saint, but a religious and perfect life. Let us not consider the good we have done, but the good we have left undone. For it will avail us nothing to have begun well unless we also end well. Understanding the passion demands active compassion, such compassion as cannot be expressed in words. It demands not only a power of deep sympathy, but actual suffering of one's own. Only by suffering ourselves can we understand at all what the passion, apart from its effects, has actually meant to those who have gone through it. I will conclude with a vision of the Venerable Anne Catherine Emmerich in the year 1820 on the Feast of the Holy Relics. Then came the relics of the apostles and the early martyrs, followed by those of whole bands of martyrs, popes, priests, confessors, hermits, virgins, and religious. They were deposited at the foot of the cross in costly vases, ornamented caskets, towers, and shrines wonderfully wrought in precious metal. And the mountain of treasures arose under the cross, which gradually ascended as the mound increased, and finally rested upon what might be termed the Transfigured Calvary. The relics were brought by those who had themselves honored them and exposed them to the veneration of the faithful. They were, for the most part, holy people whose own relics are now held in benediction. After this, I saw multitudes of well-dressed people thronging around the church with marks of deep veneration. They wore the various costumes of their times. Of the present day, I saw but a few. There were people who honored the saints and their relics as they ought to be honored, as members of the body of Jesus Christ, as holy vessels of divine grace through Jesus and in Jesus. On them I saw falling, like dew, the beneficent influence of those saints. Prosperity crowned all their undertakings. I rejoice to see here and there, in these days, some good souls, some of whom I know, still honoring relics in all simplicity. I want to thank you for your time, and may God bless you. This is Tom Serafin, and I will be doing more tapes, and I appreciate your time. God bless.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's Thomas Serafin, the president of the International Center for Holy Relics. Please do remember, all of Tom's material is copyrighted as well, so do not use it without his permission. You can reach Tom by writing to P.O. Box 21301, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90021. That's Thomas Serafin, S-E-R-A-F-I-N, P.O. Box 21301, Los Angeles, California, 90021. Thanks so much for listening to stmichaelspod.com, and we'll see you next time. Thank you, and God bless. This and all other podcasts posted on stmichaelspod.com are the property of Michael A. Barone and may not be used in any form without written permission. To do so would be a violation of all applicable copyright laws.